we think there's advantages to having an all-in-one solution, but ultimately having fewer choices is bad for the consumers. It's bad for the people that are purchasing those solutions. You do want to have competition. You want to have multiple solutions, and you want those customers to be able to choose the best of breed. Otherwise, people will stagnate and, you know, end up investing in the areas that are the most profitable for them, and then some other areas may fall behind.
Another episode of Chat GTM with Michael Beck and Chad Horn. Hey, Chad, how you doing?
Good. Hot off the heels of Food on Demand. And it's awesome because our guest today was mentioned a couple times in various conversations I had. Ooh. At the show. So.
Wow. Maybe we start that. Peter, sounds like you're famous. So as a way of an introduction, Mr. Peter Kellis, he's the CEO of a point of sales solution called Tray. They have some really fantastic applications and some really interesting differentiators that we wanted to drill into today and really just, you know, dip into to what Tray is so the world knows about it and we can start opening up some conversations around it. Peter, welcome to the show. Absolutely.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Welcome.
So, Chad, why don't we just start with there? You heard about Tray at the Food on Demand conference we were just at. Tell me a little bit about what those conversations sparked out of.
Some of it I can't disclose, but I will say this. It came up in the context of brands that were doing very, very intensive RFP processes on their POS and looking at a lot of solutions and accounting for all the variables and how Tray was faring very well in those proceedings. And one of the things that came up was the cost advantage with their approach to hardware. So I'm going to ask Peter to talk about that at some point. It sounds like you're doing things very differently, Peter. And so, as you tell us about what you're doing at Tray, really highlight those differences because it seems like those are making waves.
Definitely a different approach. We take an approach where we look at a problem from its origin. So we haven't started with a given preset idea for how a problem should have been solved. And we're looking at first principles when we look at how to solve problems. The approach that we use was it basically goes back to when I started the company. So if you'd like, I can tell you a little bit about that.
Well, how long ago was it? Actually, it's a little more fun on like the origin story side of things. So where were you when you thought of this first idea, that light bulb moment, and how long ago was it till you started really making this thing happen?
We can start there and then I'll get to hardware and so on and so forth. But I started the company 13 years ago, a little bit over that. And it was because I had a hard time getting a drink at a bar in Santa Monica. I was waiting in line to get in for 40 minutes, and then it was a 25-minute delay at the bar because there were three sets of people ahead of me. And you know, if you're at the bar, you lose eye contact with the bartender for 5 seconds, and then they forget about you, right? So I created this app. It took me about a month. I had to learn Android and Java to build it initially. I'm a coder, though, so I started coding when I was 14. I was in France, and I could not understand anything said in class because I had moved from Greece to France. Okay. But I could code my calculator, and I had an HP 48, and I started coding there. So then I went to MIT and undergrad and grad in computer science, AI, so on and so forth. So I was familiar with coding, but I had to learn Android and Java while I was doing this. And I built this prototype that let people order on their phone from a bar. The bartender would receive the order in a tablet, make the drink, and then the customer would just present their phone. The order was prepaid, and they would just take their drink. So it would eliminate that process of ordering. at a bar, which can take a long time. At the time, it seemed that restaurants and bars were not ready for this kind of solution. They thought they had good service, and some of them did. But what was what came out after doing a little bit of market research was that there were other industries that were interested in that kind of thing. And we started actually selling to bowling alleys. And bowling alleys, when people are bowling, they want to be able to have a way of ordering at the bowling lane instead of having to flag down a staff member or walk over to the concession stand. So we built this kiosk that was pretty much the app running on a device that would let people order at the bowling alley. The food would come to them while they were playing. They would have paid with a card that they swipe. And that's the genesis of Tray. And then because my background was, again, MIT, and then I worked at EMC, which is a data storage company, and it had over 35 patents in data replication, which is the ability to replicate large volumes of data across large distances in the presence of failures, through multiple links efficiently, et cetera, et cetera. I built this system from the ground up to be an enterprise class system. So it was never intended to be for a single bowling alley. It was intended to be for a chain of bowling alleys. Mm-hmm. And then we started selling to amusement parks, trampoline parks, water parks, et cetera, et cetera. When COVID happened, that became a problem because many of those places had financial issues and so on and so forth. So we decided to switch and pivot to restaurants. So even though we had the enterprise system, the restaurant-specific features were built in collaboration with Dine Brands, who at the time was looking for point-of-sale systems. And so it was almost like getting a PhD in restaurant technology by partnering with them. They really liked our architecture, which is pretty unique in the industry. We can talk about that if you like. They liked the fact, like you talked about, that we can run on existing hardware, so they didn't have to upfront replace their hardware and make that capital investment. And we partnered with them to build all the necessary features and innovate to create a best of breed offering for the restaurant space effectively. And one of the differentiators, like Chad, you mentioned, is that we found a way to effectively convert Windows systems into Android. Mm-hmm. We replace the operating system from the hardware up. So they keep the hardware, but it's a different operating system running it. So some of these devices behind me, for example, are all micros terminals and NCR terminals and PAR and so on and so forth. And we can reuse that hardware by replacing the OS with a lightweight operating system like Android that is designed to run single applications, not like Windows that's designed to manage multiple applications. It's more lightweight, uses less memory, uses less CPU, and therefore it becomes much more snappy and modern looking when it runs Tray.
How far back in the hardware cycle is it backward compatible? So we're using some hardware. What are the minimal requirements?
There are some minimal requirements, like the amount of memory that you have and so on and so forth. There's got to be some reasonably recent version of Windows. Cannot be, for example, Windows CE or anything from the 80s probably, but we had success in running in pretty old devices, 10, 15 years in some cases, more. And again, in most of these cases, the hardware itself is well built. It's robust, it's lasting, and the thing that slows it down is the operating system. It's Windows. The fact that Windows becomes out of compliance, so they cannot put a newer version of Windows to fix those issues. And the fact that it was never really built to be a mobile operating system. It was built as a multi-application management operating system, and that is what slows it down. And by running Android on those devices, and of course, not just these old devices, you can run the most modern Android devices, which are also less expensive than the old school Windows devices, but we're completely agnostic when it comes to hardware. It could be existing devices, it could be new, modern Android devices that are less expensive, and there's a variety of vendors that have really, really good price points and options for pretty much all budgets and all needs. So there could be customers that want, you know, specific screen sizes or specific configurations for what the screen looks like, or how many peripherals you want to be adding to those devices, et cetera. So we're very flexible when it comes to hardware.
Peter, did you know this was going to be an enterprise solution from the beginning, or was that a latter decision? And part two was, you know, because there's a relative void of enterprise solutions in the POS market that service full service restaurants well,
yeah,
how did that decision to do that segment of the market better than others come about?
Yeah, it's a great question. The fact that it was enterprise was basically, that's the only way I knew how to build software, right? Because I was at EMC, I was at Google, I was always thinking about large scalable systems. I couldn't even think about, like, if you were to, it's very easy to build a one restaurant point of sale system relatively,
right?
Much harder to build something that works at scale consistently, efficiently, with minimum amount of failures, with failover built into it, offline mode, all these things are, was making it complicated. But that's really, to me, in my mind, that was the only option to build it in order to make it right. So that was kind of a, not a decision, but the only way I could do it. The decision, again, or the choice to make a restaurant point of sale system was because of the market and how the market evolved for us specifically, and the fact that we got lucky and we started working with one of the biggest enterprise restaurants in the world with IHOP and Dine early on. And we kind of grew up in that space, right? So we took a really solid scalable architecture, which I think is probably the best out there in terms of how the thing is built. And then we were able to work with someone that could help guide us into making that a really great solution for restaurants. And because bowling alleys and trampoline parks, amusement parks are quick service restaurants, effectively, right? They have, they don't have servers and don't have checks, et cetera. We already have those aspects. But we now with IHOP, we were able to add all the aspects needed for full service, which is a lot of work. It's a lot of extra work.
Yeah.
So I have a question that's parallel to this, because a lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs, are tech entrepreneurs. And one of the questions I'm sure that's kind of burning in their brains is, you know, if you're working with a giant like Dine Brands, right? How do you go from the bowling alley to earning the trust in a business like that with such a high stakes category? Like, how tell us about how you made that leap. And then obviously some things you showed us about the velocity you went through, it means you've delivered to the promise and then some, but like how'd you make that sale happen, or that business relationship develop and bring it over the fence?
So I wish I could take credit, but the credit goes to the person that Dine Brands hired to find the next generation system for them with the goal of future POS at the time. So his name is Jim Melvin, and he had built some early systems back in the 80s that McDonald's ended up using. So McDonald's POS was built by Jim. So he really understood what it took to create a scalable system, how to scale to the enterprise. And the kind of system he was looking for wasn't just the surface. Do you have this feature? Do you have that feature? Because he understood that it's easy for people to add.
Right.
But the hard part was, did you architect the system in a way that will cover those areas in the next 10, 15, 20 years, right?
Yeah.
Is it a modern system? Is it a scalable system? Did you think about what happens when failures occur? Did you think about optimizing the bandwidth of the restaurant so the restaurants don't have to have massive Wi-Fi and connectivity, given some of them are in rural areas? Mm-hmm. Did you think about being agnostic of hardware and processing? Because sometimes, you know, the chains and the restaurants want a choice of who to use for hardware and what processing to use. So that's what played a critical role in how we were effectively selected. And then it came down to, did they believe that we could do it? Because at the time this election happened, we did not have everything they wanted.
Right.
But at the pace we were moving, it was clear, it became clear that we could get to where we need to be faster than others that had a head start because we could move faster.
Is that because you're just small and by nature as small as agile?
Smaller, agile, because of the way the system was architected, because of the way we were doing development in an agile methodology, whereas some of the other systems were pretty much waterfall or all building software and so on and so forth. And a lot of it came down to the team. So our team was able to work directly with the customers and cut a lot of middle layers that happen. If you don't get as lucky as to work with a very large customer to guide you from day one, which effectively we got lucky with.
Thank you. Part two on that question, I'll just really quick, from the start of that sales cycle to when you started that conversation to when that said, hey, here's ink on paper, we're moving forward, we're implementing, what? How long was that?
It took, as I said, about 2 years for the evaluation itself. During those years, we would meet with Dyn regularly and we would show them new features that we built the week before, feedback improve, and so on and so forth. In the meantime, they were working with other systems to have them prove that they could do the same thing, of course. And it took about a year to pilot, and then we signed the agreement end of 21, I believe. So, and then took a few months to get ready to start rollout, and then we finished the rollout in about a year.
I love hearing about wins. That's awesome. Yeah.
Peter, you used the term best of breed, which, all right, immediately invites that comparison. Best of breed versus all-in-one, single vendor.
Yes.
So if you're best of breed, what have you found is the profile of the buyer that likes best in breed? Is it like a certain type of brand? Is it the psychology of the CTO? I mean, what are the characteristics that make a brand a best of breed?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of everything. There's the clearly the mentality of the customer. We found that innovative customers are those that think more generally about the problem using first principles again versus what did the other CEO do, right? So there's this herd mentality versus independent thinking. Is this what's better for my business, or is it because other people have done it that I should do it? And so that innovator mentality definitely, I think, helps. It's weird because the size, you would think the size of the company would matter, the size of the chain, right? Because I hope it's a big chain. You would think those larger chains would want the ability to choose who they want for processing, who they want for hardware, who they want for loyalty. But we found some of these larger chains actually go for all-in-one. And we also found some very small chains that we have some brand new customers, like Zhou Chinese is one of them, Kernel, and so on and so forth. They have few locations, but are very innovative how they think about things. And maybe they have worked in bigger companies before, bigger brands, so they have seen the trade-offs. And maybe have been stuck with a given vendor that promised them a lot, but ended up not being able to deliver across everything. Or maybe their support model was not as great as advertised. And given the challenge they have, they think best of breed, that kind of approach is better. And there's others that just want to innovate. They just don't want the same solution everybody else has because they think technology can be a differentiator for them. And they can make something different that will entice consumers to shop there versus the next restaurant over that has the exact same technology.
When we think about like how you built this, right? And earlier you mentioned about features being requested, it seems like, at least from the outside, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that POS typically or many suffer from feature bloat. They're just too much. There's all the stuff gets loaded in there, slows it down, bogs it. And how do you kind of protect that desire to please? Oh, let's put that in there, right? Versus the what's pragmatic and practical and best for everybody. How do you gauge that?
They do need quite a few of these features, it turns out, because now not everybody needs it, but they need it for certain managers. So some stores may do something differently than other stores, or it just makes their life easier. So what we do is we build feature flags that enable certain features to be turned on or off for certain locations.
Yep.
We do it at an enterprise level that you can manage from the enterprise who gets what permission to do a certain thing and who gets what feature to, whether or not it's available to them. And that can be managed pretty much at either the franchisee level, the brand level, the regional level, or the store level, right? So it's basically many systems in one, and it lets the stores decide which of these features they want to expose.
So it's more configurability, right? It's
very, very configurable, yeah.
Got it. And yeah. And would you say, because before we started recording, you shared some I guess they call it statistics or just data about the deployment, the rapidity at which you deployed to Dine Brands, and that can we talk about that? Because that was impressive.
Yeah, we were able to roll out over 60 IHOP stores per week when we were doing the development, and we finished over 1,500 stores. If you count the amount of months that we were actually deploying in less than a year. Part of it is that we were able to reuse the hardware, right? So the hardware swapping was not part of the transition. Mm-hmm. Just the store remained open. You could be at IHOP for lunch. You started lunch and they were using the older system. You finished lunch and it was with Trey. And they did that by installing it on two out of the four terminals, let's say, and then swapping one of the, they have dual lines on their kitchens in some cases. So one line would be Trey, the other line would be the previous POS. And the store never shut down. The store continued their lunch. And then by the end of the lunch, they had a new POS. So that's one of the ways we were able to accelerate. The other way is it's an easy to use system, right? Takes minimal training. We heard stories that in the previous system, it would take 3 to 4 days to train a new staff member on how to use it. We train in some cases, but just give them the employee card and point to the system. Say, go use it. Probably an exaggeration. Probably takes a little bit more than that to use some of the items, but we actually heard that from certain franchisees. So the ease of use, ease of install, and then our team was capable of managing pretty much an army of third parties in most cases that were able to do feet on the ground and do the switch is what enabled the speed at which we moved.
So, Peter, over even this year, a handful of times we've seen companies. So this is about AI, but not like AI applications as much as it is AI assisted development, where a couple of guys in a matter of weeks or a few months develop a very robust piece of software that can go toe to toe with some other point solution in the industry. How do you think those types of companies, solutions, or even more importantly, methodologies are going to impact your world and your customers over the coming years?
So we want to be one of them. So we have a big, big initiative now for using AI tools across everything, not just development. And development, look, I did my master's in AI at MIT. So
well, AI has. We still want to have you on so many times now that we know this.
No problem. But AI came a long way from where it was, but it has been around for a long time. And people have used it in the past across the board. It's just that the LLMs, that's the new part, the deep learning. Basically, what it means is being able to leverage more data in an efficient enough way so that your query can return and give you an answer in a reasonable amount of time. You could still do it before, but it would take a long time to be usable, right? So that innovation is what's relatively new, and that is what's enabling this next wave of features and companies and all this transformation that is happening. But that idea of wanting to emulate how the human mind works was around since the 60s or the 50s with Marvin Minsky, who's a professor at MIT. Actually, he was teaching a class on what's called the Society of Mind. That was his how the mind operates, and like how do you translate that into what computers can do. Right?
Wow.
So theoretically, anything our mind can do, a computer could do if you emulate the mind closely enough. The fact now that we're able to even write any software with AI is phenomenal. It's amazing. It's mm-hmm. incredible. And we want to take full advantage of that. So we have, we're completely transforming the way the kinds of tools that we use to write software development. We made all the AI, the best AI we could find, we made it available to all the employees. Now, the thing is, it changes so quickly, right?
Like, yeah.
3 months from now, it could be a completely different set of tools. So it's always a balance between how much you invest in a given technology versus how long do you wait until you find the right technology.
It feels like it'd almost be a no-brainer for deployments when you have a very configurable solution. Instead of having people do all the settings back and forth, you'd have a certain set that this attribute, and then the agent would just go, what? Everything's lit up across the board, right?
Definitely one application, right?
You
could have the AI go and do the configuration, or you could go have it figure out what the right configuration is for a particular store given what
attributes.
But in terms of development, like for example, if you go to our integrations website page, so if you go to trade.com and then you navigate where it says integrations and partners, you'll see we have a list of the different integrations, and you can filter and say which ones are available, which ones are for loyalty, which ones are for payments. That entire page was generated by AI.
Wow.
All we gave the AI was, here's a table that shows a name of what the integration that we did was and the status of the integration. And then it figured out the UI, it figured out how to build the filtering, the format, the colors, everything was done by AI. So similarly, now when we're designing product features or UIs, we leverage AI deeply and we say, you know, this is what we have now, this is what we'd like to do. It saves quite a bit of time. We're not at the point where it does most of the work. And I think there's no point where it can do it by itself. You're always gonna need guidance in humans, but I think we're gonna be at the point where we can be 30 to 40% more effective this year. Mm-hmm. And then next year will be hopefully even better. So even though we're a relatively small team, we have, I would say 100, 150, well, depending on who you count as product or engineering or developer, 150 people working on the product. Mm-hmm. I think by using
AI,
but it could be a much bigger, it could effectively perform as a way, way bigger company. And it's better to have fewer people working on something using tools and leveraging tools than trying to coordinate a big team of people, right? And I think it is a big opportunity for entrepreneurs that are either by themselves or have a small team to punch way above their class with these tools that are becoming available. And it's exciting because it rewards pretty much innovation and how far you can take the tools that are available. That's the limiting factor versus how much funding you're going to have and so on and so forth.
Peter, in my prior life, where I encountered a lot of brands and the integrations they would use, I found that the enterprise brand would typically use around 8 solutions integrated to the POS. Yeah, I'm sure that it may have changed since then. But given that, you must, and being a best in breed solution, you must have some philosophy and strategy and operation related to partnerships and integrations to make the whole solution of a brand work. What are you doing there?
Well, the main difference is that with our integrations, we're truly partners because typically we don't compete with the vendor that we integrate with.
Mm-hmm.
Other companies will say they're open and they'll say they're integrating. But if they have all the components that they presumably want others to build for them, then their sales teams might want to prioritize the homemade solution, right? Versus truly being open.
Or they might drag their feet.
Or maybe they might drag their feet. Right. Or they want to charge a fee, right?
Yeah. Like
per call fee to the API, just because. Yeah. So I think that's the main difference, is that we're truly, truly want this ecosystem to work. And whoever we integrate with, we want them to be successful as partners. And we truly feel like we're partners. We want to have the best solution. We want them to have the best solution. And we want our customers to have a choice of what solutions they get versus getting locked in or pigeonholed in a particular ecosystem. We think there's advantages to having an all-in-one solution, but ultimately having fewer choices is bad for the consumers. It's bad for the people that are purchasing those solutions. You do want to have competition. You want to have multiple solutions, and you want those customers to be able to choose the best of breed. Otherwise, people will stagnate and, you know, end up investing in the areas that are the most profitable for them, and then some other areas may fall behind.
Thinking about the future, right? Because we're talking about, you know, innovation and AI and where the hockey puck is going, so to speak, right? And you might not be able to share this with us, but one of my questions is, you know, what's one feature or idea that's on your roadmap that no one's asking for yet, but they will, right? Is there something like that that you're toying with?
I can tell you about one that I'm thinking about. Is so you heard about voice ordering, right? And this company that are doing voice ordering, but it's typically either one that's a call center, so they call to place an order, or at the drive-thru. What I'm interested in is to see how that would work at a table and how the voice assists the server to either build the order or upsell or whatever. So effectively, they would be using a tablet and it would listen to the conversation. And instead of the server having to search and punch for...
Oh, like a co-pilot. Yeah.
Yeah, it would kind of pre-build the cart and let them, effectively making them more efficient and giving them more time to interact with a customer versus punching in stuff on their little tablet.
Are you saying even as far as it's listening to maybe the guest is oscillating between a couple of menu items and it'll actually say, hey, listen, let's go this way?
Yeah, exactly. So it could be pretty much a super server, right? It's an awesome tool to help the server that's taking the order be even more effective, even if they hadn't been highly trained of here's all the different upsell opportunities, right?
The server's not even keying it in. They're just validating the order as they're having the conversation with the guest and being more present.
And you could even have, hey, here's some other things you should tell them about.
Yeah.
What if you suggest this item and so on and so forth?
I wonder if the thing they're holding has a little OCB on the back. So they can actually see what's coming up as they're talking.
That would be very interesting, right? Or like, hey, here are some pairings for the food that you're about to order. So this is the kind of stuff that I think would be interesting. We have some new, really cool new stuff that we're introducing in terms of how ordering happens at a table. So typically, you probably have seen barcodes at a table. You can scan a barcode and order on your phone. You've seen kiosks at a table where you can change the order and maybe play some games. But typically, those things are bolt-ons to the POS. Third parties that bolt onto the POS, and there's really it's hard for the experience to be balanced between how much work the server does in terms of what that order looks like versus how much self-ordering is happening on that table.
Right.
We have a solution now we're about to implement in one of our customers where it's pretty much a hybrid approach between the two. And it basically gives complete freedom to the person ordering to either order through a server or the barcode on the table or a mix of the two. So the order could open on a tablet, so the server could come in, grab the card, swipe the card, so there's a check and a tab open, leave, and then the customer does the ordering, and they add as many items as they want, and then they pay and they split as many ways as they want between themselves. For example, they could present their phone with a barcode to their co-diner, I guess, and the co-diner could add their credit card to the bill and then split the check.
That's cool.
Or it could be that they've added a few items, the server comes back and says, you know, what about, do you want an extra beer? And then the server adds it on their tablet. And it's basically the same check, whether it's viewed by the customer or their co-designer or the server, right? So it is pretty cool. And I think a lot of the full service brands are looking for innovative ways to approach ordering and how consumers want to order more themselves. Right? They want to do self-ordering without requiring expensive hardware that could, that has to sit in every table and so on and so forth, but without taking away the benefits of having a brand representative, right, if you will, like the server taking the order and interacting with the customers.
I've talked to a few companies over the years that wanted to do something like that, but so many POS systems in third parties, you can't even modify a check once opened on the POS. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, it's a non-starter.
You would love to be introduced to them, actually. So.
Very cool.
So more on the personal side, right? Like just something fun. What restaurant do you personally geek out over, whether it's as a diner or as a, let's call it a tech observer, right? Like what restaurants are you looking at going, you know, I love what they do or how they do it, but yeah.
Well, I live in Brickell in Miami.
Okay.
It's a very diverse community when it comes to restaurants. There's all sorts of restaurants here, all the way from really upscale steakhouses to little markets that sell sushi that they make fresh. I don't know. I like variety. I don't like, there's no one specific kind of restaurant that I would say excites me. I like having access to all of them. I'm going to use this question to pitch Brickell versus a particular type of food. I think Brickell is it's almost like the next Silicon Valley now. There's a lot of investment happening here. There's a lot of new startups moving here. A lot of finance companies. Google is actually going to open an office here, I heard. And they're building 46 new towers over the next 5 years in this small area that is Brickell, Miami. I think people should consider it. The weather is great.
It is a nice place to be, and there's no shortage of delicious food at the restaurant.
Well, if I can squeeze in one last question, I know a lot of brands over the last few years have really focused more on their data strategy and are flipping it, and rather than looking at, hey, what can I do with my data given my POS? What's my data strategy? What POS should I use to complement my strategy? Where do you fit into a modern data-first strategy?
So data is extremely important. When I was at Google, initially I was the product manager for all of the Google big data technologies, like Bigtable, BigQuery, and so on and so forth. And then I moved into the AdSense world, what they call monetization world. I created a product called Google Campaign Insights that measures effectiveness of advertising, that is display advertising as opposed to search advertising, because search is much easier to measure. And it was all about data, and it was all about understanding consumer behavior online. What happens is when consumers go buy something in retail at a restaurant or store that's not online, nobody has data. You kind of lose the consumer, right? And that's called the last mile problem, or at least that's what Google called it at the time. And Trey, in particular, we built, because I used to be at Google and because I understand the importance of knowing your customer, everything within Trey. You know, some people call it unified commerce, right? But that term is, I think people use it differently. Some people mean to say that I bought a bunch of companies, I glue them together, and therefore you can
sure.
do unified commerce. Some people can mean, oh, I can modify my menu in this one place, and then all these other places are going to get it. What we mean by unified commerce is, as a consumer, when I come to the restaurant, am I going to have a unified experience as if I were to order online or through a third party, et cetera, et cetera? So we have a unified customer profile. We actually have customers' profile built into Trey so that you can input the customer's information, phone number, email, whether the order comes online, whether you're on the POS, whether you're using loyalty. And that was pretty much because we started as an app, right? We started as an app where the user downloads the app to put their information, and then we track that user across whether they pay through a kiosk or they come through, pay through a POS, et cetera. We have that capability of having that user profile across every single product we do, whether it's a kiosk, online ordering, POS, KDS even, right? It's the same name of the customer that can appear there or part of it for privacy and so on. But as that aspect becomes important, we have the right infrastructure already built to take advantage of the ability to track the consumer across all the stages. We don't have a specific product in that area, for example, but again, we're open to, and we have the piping, and we're open to integrating with the right technologies, whatever the particular restaurant wants to do.
Okay.
And one more zinger, so to speak, because people have been talking about it here and there for years. Do you think there's a point in time, let's say in the next 5, 10 years, with the proliferation of mobile devices, right, and people having all this horsepower and computing in their pockets, and the move toward cashless transactions, that we're now going to be looking at a restaurant that has a different digital or hardware footprint, where it might be relegated to the business having mobile devices, maybe no registers in the
business, right? We partner with some of these customers already. We were partnering some customers that had no terminals, no POS, just kiosks and barcode. So customers could order barcode. And I think there's a lot of experimentation happening in that space. I don't know that anybody has solved that particular problem. The technology is definitely there if they want to do it.
They probably alienate part of the market based on age and more demographic, right, at this point in time.
I think the other thing is that people do still want some interaction. So you've seen kiosks at McDonald's and so on.
Right.
It helps, and it definitely helps if they're understaffed or they want to be understaffed on purpose, or if there's too many people ordering and the customer wants an easier way to order.
Yeah. But
there is an element of if you go out, you do want another human being to service you, right? So there's still an element of that. Now, I think if somebody cracks the code of what it looks like to be completely self-service, I think more power to them. And I think definitely the technology as is today can support it. And with AI, I think like that's going to be even more so the case, right?
Well, especially with, as you're talking about consumer data and knowing your customer and being that all their attributes are probably here already, that they can just pair that up to any experience they're having.
Exactly.
Exciting times.
Imagine like having even like a virtual server that's an AI talking to you. It's not even that.
Well, it might be even your own agent that knows your diet living on your device or whatever, that they can then talk to the agent of the restaurant. Right, that now they're having a negotiation of what menu items they're even going to give you and present you with all your most ideal situations.
Yeah, that's meta level, right? You have your agent, the restaurant's agent, none of you actually interact, right? And then the food suddenly appears, and that's interesting.
So several months ago, Chad and I were hopping on a conference call, and this is when we first started seeing the note takers show up. And we had a meeting, and there were 7 AIs there and 3 people. They sent all their agents ahead, reminding me of Real Genius back in the 80s, where they had the professors teaching the class, and it was a couple of recorders, and then it was ultimately the recorder, the professor didn't show up, and he had the recorder playing, and the class was recorders. So at some point, I don't know if we need to go to work.
Exactly, right? At what point it's just the agents and not the people, right?
Yeah.
Do the listening and the work and the communicating, maybe they go do the work too.
Right. I think, to your point though, with fine dining and table service and experiential dining, the people are such a critical component. And I think AI is almost a robotic enhancement, or whatever you want to say that, isn't a good proxy, because they're looking for a human experience, right?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a helper in many ways, but maybe not a full replacement.
Yeah. Even then, fast food, that's more transactional, where there's a little bit of fatigue around the exchange, and also labor pressures, feels like that's more of a natural fit.
Yeah.
Peter, I didn't know you before. I really want to know you now. You mentioned Google, you mentioned MIT, like you have all this stuff. So we definitely want to have you back on the show if you're down to jam on some stuff or those things come up.
That was fun. Appreciate it.
So let's talk about how people can find you or where you're going to be next. I've seen you at shows before, and we're still part of the show season. We got NRA coming up and some other stuff. Where are you going to be this year?
So our next show, we're going to have a booth. It's going to be FS Tech in September.
Orlando. Yes.
Yeah. NRA it's a great show. It's not as much enterprise focused, so it's not really the right show for us. We'll be there. We'll be there attending, but not presenting. So FS Tech, Muir Tech, and RLC are typically our biggest shows.
Fantastic. And then your website for everybody, just make sure they know how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, trey.com, 4-letter English word. So.
Beautiful. Chad, do you have any other questions here before we wrap up?
No questions. Just Peter, this has been an awesome conversation. I learned a lot about you and Trey, and but my already positive opinion improved. So thank you for the time today.
I appreciate your time, guys. I'm looking forward to more.
Absolutely. Right. Genuinely excited. And then we're going to take a quick picture together for our thumbnail after this. But everybody, thank you so much for joining us here. This has been Peter Kellis with Trey. If you have any questions about his solutions, how he thinks about the world, I believe, Peter, I've seen you on LinkedIn as well. People can probably reach out there and send you a note.
And
he'll be wandering around the NRA show, and we'll see him over at FS Tech as well. So, Peter, thank you so much. And everybody, thank you for investing your time with us today. And we look forward to seeing you on our next episode.
Thank you all.